Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Nicks, what's happening? How's it going? This is Mark. It's me, Mark Maron. This is my show. Thanks for joining. Today, on the show, I talked to J. Smith Cameron. Her name is Jean. You guys may know her as Jerry from Succession. She's done a lot of work. She was also in the movies Margaret and You Can Count on Me, directed by her husband, Kenneth Lonergan, who I've talked to, and many other films and TV series and plays. She's great, and I was thrilled to talk to her. Also, today, or Sunday, yesterday, I just talked to Rachel Weisz, and that was exciting. She's great. She's great. And that was like, I think that was the only person I talked to all day. And I've had a week of that where, you know, Kit works. I go do comedy at night, talk to Lipside a few times. I don't know, man. I just think it's important. I got to find somebody to talk to / bounce shit off of in town, go out, do the coffee thing, crunch the news, think about stuff, break new ground, push the envelope, talk about movies. I just watched that thing that Vice is in, that Dead Ringers, and it blew my mind entirely. My mind just getting blown all the time. I don't know if I'm getting old or what, but I'm just sort of like, oh my God, this is insane. Everything's in here. It's radical. I don't know. I'm going soft maybe. I don't know. But listen, a couple of things I left hanging, I believe. So Buster was actually sick. And he had a UTI that might have affected his kidneys. He had infection. And I think I told you that they gave me antibiotics to give him by mouth, which is a goddamn charade. Ridiculous. But I brought him in for a shot. And he's doing great. Seems great. They all seem great. Cats are fine. And in personal news, I went and got my blood test on Friday. This is after 3 months of pretty strict veganism. I might have ingested partial egg here and there with some bread products that I didn't or wasn't aware of. 3 months as a vegan and really limiting to maybe 4 or 5 times in that 3 months my intake of processed sugar. Because as you know, some of you, if you've been following along, that my sugar, my glycemic index is 5.8, which is pre-diabetic. My LDL before this, before I went vegan, was, you know, hovering around, I think, 125 to 127, my LDL. My good cholesterol is good, 70-something, I don't know. So I got blood. And I asked him to give me a testosterone test, too, because I talked to some friend of mine who said I should get that. And that's my form of referral. Talk to a guy my age who someone told to get their thing checked. Maybe you should get that checked. So I got all these blood tests, and the results came, but the doctor hasn't chimed in yet. And here's the thing about the cholesterol. After 3 months vegan, 102. And it's supposed to be below 100. So there's nothing I can fucking do. My LDL is 102. My HDL is 72. Triglycerides, 54. Non-HDL, 113. Total, somehow, 185. Which isn't bad, but there's nothing I can do. I guess you're supposed to, it's just supposed to be around 80. Your cholesterol. So I got to make some choices. My testosterone, 1,027. Huh. I guess that's high. And for some reason, of course, as a man, I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah, man. Fuck yes. 1,027. I'm full of this stuff. What does it mean? Is it good or bad? I don't know. Doctor hasn't weighed in yet. So that's the deal. So now I imagine he's going to tell me to get back on the statin. Why not? But then the big question is, what about my diet? Do I stay on this thing? I've certainly been having a good time focusing. It's nice to, you know, have an ideological eating disorder. Gotten some good jokes around it. I believe in my heart that I've probably eaten enough meat for one lifetime. But do I get back on the statin and do the occasional fishy fish? What do I do? Do I just stay with it? I feel like people have invested a lot of faith and excitement and belief in me around this vegan thing. People are sending me snacks. Nothing wrong with that. And I seem to have gotten out of the frame of thinking that I should just do whatever the hell I want because life is short. You know, you get these just people who, like, barbecue guys, the meat cult. The barbecue cult. Just, you know, obese dudes with beards and aprons slathering sauce onto ribs. Come on, live a little. Yeah, very little, much longer. At that rate, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll see what the doc says. It's also my testosterone is flagged. I don't know what having a slightly high testosterone means anyways. Anyway, so it's all unfolding. Blood pressure's good. Heart rate's good. Everything's okay. And I got some text from some guy, not a text, some direct message about how cholesterol doesn't matter. But I asked my doctor again. Is it still an indicator or has it no bearing on heart health? And he looked at me like I was a fucking moron. Like a fucking moron. That's how he looked at me. He's like, yeah, it is an indicator. And I'm like, oh, because some guy DM'd me that I don't know on Instagram about how it doesn't matter. All right. Well, so I guess he's wrong then. The guy on Instagram who you don't know, who DM'd you, that said cholesterol's not an indicator? No, that, yeah, I would go with whatever he says. Go with whatever that guy says. I've been invited over to somebody's house for dinner, Kit and myself, and I bought a full tray, a $35 tray, which is not nothing when you're buying baklava. Yeah, I figure, like, why not bring a nice local treat over. That would be a nice thing to do. And it's basically, you know, it's like 10 to 12 different kinds of the same thing. Yeah. Slight variation on what the dough is doing texturally and which nut is being used. But outside of that, kind of thematic. All right, look, so Succession is currently in its fourth and final season. New episodes are on Sunday nights. You can stream the whole series up to this point on HBO Max. And J. Smith Cameron, who is my guest today, plays Jerry. Her name is Jean, not the initial J. And we had a lovely conversation that you can be part of right now. What? So why don't you just tell me how it ends?
No, I can't do that. First of all, I don't really know because they
what?
They well because,
they kill you off next episode.
No, uh-huh. No, but they but I they. I mean, I play a secondary sort of character,
right.
And a lot of my stuff ends up on the cutting room floor. I don't really know my story, how it's being told exactly.
Is that, do you find that disappointing? That they cut stuff out?
Yeah, like, duh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I mean, does it, how much does it happen?
Well, because I'm, first of all, like.
Not that I'm looking for complaints. I'm just saying like,
no,
because
no.
Like, do you guys, how much do you overshoot? Do you know what I mean?
A lot.
Yeah.
So, and they find, I think, a lot of gold that way. And some of it is improv, and they just leave the camera rolling sometimes. They don't print all that because they're
right.
Working with film.
Sure. Oh, really?
So it's not like digital where they can just do it.
Right.
Right.
So there's a lot of improvising.
There's quite a bit.
Would you do like one take on script and then just go the next
yes.
take kind of thing?
No. No, it's sort of like, I remember when we first, the very first scene I shot, we... He said, let's do it as written, and then, you know, after that, we'll just mess it up.
Right.
And he just, that was Mark Mylod, the director, saying that. And he was, and that is less true as they've developed their crazy shooting style. Like, they kind of, they don't want it to be complete chaos because it's already this chaotic, cool camera work they're doing.
Yeah.
But we always get what they call a freebie at the end.
Yeah.
Kinda.
And they use it sometimes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, the whole Roman Jerry
thing,
relationship, whatever you call it, came from just the camera rolling and Kieran and I flirting and being silly in character.
Uh-huh.
And well, they
in like season one?
Yeah, the end of season one.
Yeah.
And we just ran out of dialogue, but they didn't say cut. So
right. So that started
to
happen?
Kept, you know, yeah, we had a little... badinage about something ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then I walked off and I kind of looked, checked him out, and he apparently checked me out right after and they were all laughing, looking at it at Video Village and like how silly it was. And then they decided to write it in.
That's hilarious. Yeah. I was excited. I was excited to, for it to come back. It's nice to have that Sunday night thing again. And I think I probably could have gotten access to press screeners of the first four, but I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Because I want to watch them with everybody else.
Yeah. Me too, really.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's why it's a little hard for me to know, like, whether, like, there's an episode coming up, but I can't remember what number it is.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't talk about it yet, right? But it's coming up. But
yeah.
How can I put this? So my character survives a certain... situation.
Ordeal.
Uh-huh. And we never really see how. And it's just, I guess, this idea that Jerry, my character, is this like bulletproof monk and that everybody understands that she would always end up on her feet or whatever.
Yeah.
But I had pitched myself for this scene.
Yeah.
They went for it. They wrote me in it. Then I improvised more. It was like everyone's favorite scene. And now it's not in the show.
Really?
Because it's not central to the... I mean, I think what Jesse Armstrong's interested in is the family drama foremost.
Right.
But he created this really wonderful world of like...
Characters
and this whole venal, you know, powerful, rich people world that is so topical to in our country, well, really globally.
Sure.
It's like, you know.
Yeah.
So it's hard for us non-Roys to like realize because our stuff, you know, like I feel like I created my character almost out of, you know, I sort of made her up. Like she, like,
but
to begin with.
And what was the audition?
The audition was some sides that were either going to be for Frank or Jerry or Carl. They didn't know.
Uh-huh.
And they were like scenes with the boys. And so they decided, oh, maybe the general counsel could be a woman. So they were also seeing, you know, starting to see some women. And I went in and read for it. And I remember thinking that it's great they hadn't rewritten it to be a female character, at least for the audition, because then I think it was Roman's character, naturally, was being really coarse in the scene and crude and saying gross stuff.
Yeah.
And I got to, on my audition tape, just be like unimpressed with them and unflappable. But it was meant more if you're a girl, an older lady, you know, like that sort of had.
Yeah.
And it was sort of, and I, but I would kind of wince like when he got too disgusting.
Right.
And then that became sort of a character thing.
Yeah.
And then I got to just kind of, I mean, I think we all did in a way, but this character was really just like, I think, one of many suits they had to kind of create and invent. And I'm sure, you know, it's a combination with all of us of what's their writing and what is our personalities and our imagination.
Well, it's all very interesting because all of the characters are really acting in reaction to Brian's character.
Yeah.
I mean, that's everyone in the show.
Yeah.
Either like whether it's in a scene or it's just hanging in the air.
It's hanging in the air. Right. He doesn't have to be in the scene.
Right. It's just everyone is reacting in their spineless ways.
Yeah.
Of one kind or another.
That's right.
To try to survive that family.
Yeah.
Including the family.
To stay in the loop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think I may be the only character who ever really yelled at Logan Roy.
Yeah.
And the scene about the feds.
Oh, yeah.
Cooperating with that. And I got to really yell at him, and it was really satisfying.
Was it?
Oh, yeah.
Is it? And also the other, the two men that are in your crew, what are their jobs? Are they all lawyers? Like, there's the one guy.
Oh, they're like COO and chief financial officer, CFO, and I was the general counsel.
Yeah,
and
then, yeah. So you're the only real lawyer?
No, I imagine there's like a whole floor of the huge high rise that's legal. But I'm the general counsel, and I oversee all the acquisitions.
But what they're doing, you know, with like Peter Friedman and David Rash.
Rashi.
It's hilarious.
I know. They're great. They're so good.
Like, I get like—
God, they're so good.
Well, you kind of all work together in that zone at times, right?
Right.
And you and Fisher Stevens, too.
Fisher. Yeah. I love it. Do you know Fisher Stevens?
I don't know him.
I thought everybody knew him. That's
why. Well, no, I mean, I know of him.
Yeah, sure. No, he's just been around a long time.
He has. I do not think I've interviewed him. Like, it's gotten to that point with this show where I'm not entirely sure anymore.
Really?
If I've interviewed people. It might be— My brain, too. I'm getting older.
Right.
But, I mean, we've done like 1,500 of them.
I mean, that's amazing.
So I assume I've interviewed everybody, but I would have remembered Fisher Stevens, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
You know what I mean? Yeah. He's kind of a character.
He's a character, yeah.
But now I got to ask my producer.
But, I mean, even if you hadn't interviewed him, you might have met him at a dozen parties because he's—
I feel like he's one of those guys has been around my entire life. Yeah. One way, I think I saw him on Broadway in a Neil Simon play.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Right? Like, I can't remember, Brighton Beach Memoirs,
maybe? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, he was the kid.
I think he replaced Matthew.
Right.
Yeah. And so Kenny, my husband, Matthew, Fisher, they all go back that far to, like, practically teenagers.
Is that true? Mm-hmm. Your husband, Kenneth Lonergan?
Yes, Kenneth Lonergan.
he started when he was that young?
Well, yes, he was one of the, I think he was the first year that they did the Young Playwrights Festival.
Yeah.
And he was 18 and they picked his play as one of the plays.
Which one?
I mean, no, it was not a play we know now. It's like a kid play that he wrote.
Didn't I just see him, like a resurrected play of his with Elaine May?
Oh, yeah.
What was that?
That's called The Waverly Gallery.
That was good.
Yeah, that's good. And she was, oh my God, did you see her in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was tremendous, I thought.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And you work with her daughter now, kind of.
Yes, and also, but I had scenes with her and Margaret.
And Margaret,
and also,
yeah.
I did an Elaine May play on Broadway with Jeannie.
Yeah. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You did, what play? You don't remember?
I think it was called After the Night in the Music, and it was actually three plays.
Yeah.
Like an evening of three funny plays by her.
Wild. What's Kenny think of this Succession?
He loves it.
Yeah?
Yeah, he loves it.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
It would be bad if you were on a show that he didn't like. I would imagine that wouldn't be a great situation.
No.
But you probably have.
But right. Well, he's pretty, he's pretty, you know, game. He realizes that, you know, like on TV, it's not like you're not always going to get quality control about every single job you have. Quite the climate.
But I mean, just on a language level, this thing is just a monster.
Right.
Right?
It's thrilling.
It is.
And the camera work.
Yeah.
And the—
Well, just sort of everything. Like, there's like, it's like, it's a language unto itself. So all these characters have to work within it. I mean, it may seem natural, but it's totally not natural.
Thank you. That's right. Thank you. Because I have all these speeches where I have to like rattle off the you know, exposition about, don't ask me what I'm saying. But And it's very hard. And it's written like you change tenses in the middle of a sentence. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to memorize.
Yeah,
and,
I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not – there's nothing normal about it. But because of the world and the nature of the emotional structure of this family and, and the business.
And that business.
That, you know, you
there's
kind of
– chaos, like a –
And you roll with it.
Yeah.
And there's a comedy to it, but it's perfectly expressive, you know, as characters. You know, you don't lose anything. I mean, that might be because of the actors, but you certainly – it's not – the language isn't really hiding anything. You know, the characters are all fully formed. You don't feel like the language is stilted to the point where the characters can't come out.
No, the characters are all distinct.
Yeah.
And they all have their own way of speaking, but they also all speak – Succession, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of an odd, it's like Oscar Wilde or something. I mean, not like Oscar Wilde, but equivalent in a way.
Yeah, it's something. Or something like that. I feel like it's like Mamet. It's like early Mamet-y.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Where there's a clip to it.
There's a world of the language.
Yes.
But then the characters also have their own voice.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like,
there's a whole universe of Succession. Like the, you know, not just the language, but like, everything about it.
What's going on out there with the fans? How's that working?
What do you mean about?
I mean,
the,
like, are you engaging with the fans?
Well, I'm on Twitter.
Yeah.
For I don't know if I'll, you're on Twitter.
I am.
Very,
yeah.
Very prominently.
Kinda. I mean, I don't do much but promote this show. I don't engage. But every once in a while, I'll do a flurry of things. But I don't fool around with it too much.
A flurry of Twittering.
Yeah, I can't take the abuse.
Oh, it's awful. But I'm not sure what's going to happen to it now.
I think what's happening is it's slowly dying.
Yeah.
It's like people don't give a shit anymore. It doesn't have this sort of vitality of it. People are, like, most of the people that were very active on it are sort of like, well, it seems to be not great anymore, but I'm not going to go and, you know. But you're engaging directly with the people?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's just interesting, like, this character, there's all these, like, you know, young women or women who have – or older women who have been in careers like this their whole life who really are just happy there's a character like that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It depicts a certain thing that hasn't really been
specifically
revealed before, apparently. And
interesting.
So, yeah. So it's kind of a role model in a way, although I wouldn't think anyone in this universe of Succession would be a role model.
Oh, people love that shit. No, of course they would. They want to be – people want to be monsters.
Yeah, maybe so.
Are you kidding me? That's what, you know, Trump has got the country divided. People want to be monsters.
Yeah.
They're just like the – it's been unleashed in the culture.
Yeah.
This sort of like, you know, shameless monstering.
Yeah. That's a – Hey, that's a good title.
Shameless Monstering?
Well, like the 60 Minutes with Marjorie.
I don't even know what happened there. I didn't watch it. I'm just seeing.
You don't want to know.
I'm just seeing the backlash. And it's just sort of like, you can't feed the monsters and act like it's regular journalism time.
I know.
It's like when Bill Maher had Steve Bannon on. It's like, you can't do that.
I know.
He's gonna make a meal out of you. They're going to make a meal out of you because they have no respect for the context.
No, but I think that I guess the media world, I don't mean to lump them all together.
Yeah.
But that they got sort of spoiled. There was just this 24-hour news cycle of all the bad stuff that bad boy Trump did.
Yeah.
That they were just in some way must have been in pig heaven. You know, like there was just so much.
Yeah.
To report. And they were just so, you know.
Well, all the media has become Page Six, right?
So yes, exactly.
So, like, since Trump was Trump in New York back in the day, and the New York Post would be excited.
In Page Six. Right.
But now that's all media. That's,
I know.
That's what it is, all tabloid-driven, clickbait bullshit.
So that's maybe another reason why Succession is so popular, because it's a media company.
Sure. But people are fascinated with rich people.
Rich people.
And power.
And yeah, people exploit power.
Yeah.
And also, it's just, they're funny. I mean,
and it's all anti-hero shit. It's like none of these people are without fault that borders on incapacitating your empathy.
Wait, say that again.
It just means that all the characters are kind of shitty.
Yeah.
And, you know, and within the world, you engage empathetically with them. But the bottom line is like, they all got it coming. Whatever they got coming.
That's true. Yeah.
So it makes it kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you read it, did you realize that it was going to be this amazing thing? Or you just had a scene?
I just had a scene.
Wow.
But I did right away, like, if I'd been a doggy, my little ears would have perked up or my little nose would have started twitching. Like, I knew right away with that scene that it was really good and really funny. I didn't know what the situations were, but I could, like, the rhythm of it and the, there were just some jokes in it that were really funny. And I just was like, oh, I want to do this. And I was just supposed to be in like 4 episodes. It was a guest star.
Yeah.
And then I ended up being in every episode that year. And then I came back as a regular, et cetera.
Yeah. Wow. It's weird, you know, because like I was like looking up stuff on you and you're, you know, it, this happens with theater people too, that I've noticed is who've worked in film and television. It's like, where's the theater resume on Wikipedia? I want to see all the plays.
I know. Well,
I mean, because like, because that's where you were.
I know.
I
know, it's kind of sad.
Well, I know, but like some people have the theater or the stage. Like there's usually film, TV, stage sometimes.
Oh, you mean on Wikipedia?
Yeah, somebody's got to do it. I don't know how it works.
Yeah, Wikipedia's a mystery to me.
I mean, too.
I'm glad it exists because I've used it millions of times and it's helpful.
Sometimes it's wrong.
Yeah, sometimes it's wrong, as in the case, like I'm scared to look at mine sometimes.
Yeah, I haven't looked at mine lately, but I had a guest on here. I think it was Pam Adelon, who I did research on, but her wiki page was like, not true. Like, it was like somebody else's wiki page.
Yeah.
Like, but it wasn't like nasty stuff. It was just not her life.
Yeah.
And it was, so I'm going into this interview.
Is it all mixed up?
Yeah, just assuming all this stuff. And it's like, none of it was, I don't know, it was some.
My daughter, when she was like maybe in middle school or something, went through a period of going on Wikipedia and changing my age by a few years. She didn't like that, how old I was. I didn't know she was doing it.
That's a nice thing.
That's sweet.
But you say you got to New York, you were around, like when was that Brighton Beach Benmore's? So you were in that world already? That feels like it was a million years ago.
No, I wasn't in that. I mean, I didn't know them. I remember seeing the play like you did, you know. But I just moved to New York.
What year?
But I want to say just early 80s.
Really?
Maybe it's mid 80s.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember, I don't know. I'm so foggy anyway.
Why is that happening to us?
I don't know.
I get nervous. Like, is it gone for good? Is this like, I was sitting there watching Succession with my girlfriend who's younger and has a full mind. I got a brain fart going. I can't remember Brian's name. I'm like, what's going on? I know that guy. And sometimes it just goes away.
Yeah, yeah. That's happened to me too.
It does?
Oh, yes.
It's the worst. With people you know a long time? Now I'm kind of obsessed with the whole memory thing.
Yeah.
Like I had, in the middle of the night, I was like, I couldn't remember. And I didn't even know why it was this particular guy. But I was just trying to remember some guy I know. And I couldn't quite get it. And I was just twisting.
And it's so alarming when it happens that then maybe your anxiety gets in the way of remembering it. Don't you think?
Yeah. Sure.
So it becomes really like, I know, it makes your blood pressure go up or something. You're like, what is happening?
But I didn't even need to think about this guy. For some reason, his brain, his name was stuck.
Yeah.
But anyway, so where do you come from? Where'd you grow up?
I come from Mars.
You do? You're one of them?
Yeah. Maybe. Well, I was born in Kentucky. And then my family moved when I was about 6 or 7, I guess, to the Carolinas, mostly South Carolina. Mostly grew up in South Carolina.
In like Charleston?
I wish. No, Greenville, which actually turned out to be a really nice town.
Yeah?
But Charleston's the really pretty famous town.
Yeah, it's all right. You know, it's a beach town. You know, it's kind of a touristy, weird thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quaint and cute and, you know, it's got a lot of charm.
A lot of history to it.
Sure.
It's fascinating, sort of.
I guess so. But, like, it's still one of those towns that's got, you know, streets full of shitty stores for tourists.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, way to ruin it for me.
No, I mean, I...
No, there's really good restaurants there.
Sure,
and they have, like...
Yeah, I was
sort
down
of a
there. I've been to...
cultured place.
Yeah, yeah. It's Southern, old Southern culture.
I mean, it's got such heinous beginning of slavery, horrible roots that, and just so much like, it's sort of so fascinating historically.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I dug in to those roots.
No.
I wasn't there long enough.
Yeah.
But I had an okay time. I stayed at a nice hotel, I think.
Good.
I feel like.
I went there when I was, I played violin when I was growing up.
That was your thing?
I guess so. I mean.
Your choice? Not your parents? Were your parents arty people?
My parents, sort of.
Yeah.
My parents had determined I would play the violin.
They did.
That's true.
Yeah.
But I was happy to try it, and I did. I played okay. I mean, I played well, I think. I was in it for a long time. Anyway, I was going to say that when I was in I was maybe a freshman in high school or possibly in junior high, and I made it into All-State Orchestra.
Yeah.
And it took place in Charleston at an old, at Ashley something, Hall, yeah. Ashley Hall or something,
yeah.
This beautiful old school. But all the other kids in the orchestra were like groovy teenagers, or that's how they seemed to me.
Yeah, sure.
And the other guy I shared a stand with, his name was Alan. I don't know what happened to this guy.
Yeah.
But we were like on our own at lunchtimes and at dinner times. And I remember this one time we just had to walk across the street to McDonald's because no one took us to dinner with them because we were like the nerdy little kids. And we found a place on the fence at Ashley Hall where the spikes had come off. You know, it was like a wrought iron fence.
Yeah.
And so we put ketchup on our white shirts, our uniform white shirts, and then hung ourselves over over I was like, poor us, see what you made us do. And they were, of course, like, oh, brother, hope you have another white shirt in your suitcase.
Look at the dumb nerds with their
their stupid sense of humor.
But you guys had a good time.
Yeah.
Were you a good violin player?
I think I was pretty good.
Yeah?
It was never my passion, but I think I—
Could you pick it up again and—
No, I think I would need to take lessons again.
But you could hold it and play it. Probably.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, I can play it, and I can play it a little bit.
Yeah?
But I would need a refresher course if I were really to take it up.
And you, like, how big of a family you come?
I have a brother and a sister.
Uh-huh. And your parents, like, just moved around a lot?
Yeah, I'm not sure why. I mean, not just all within South Carolina or all, you know, like.
Yeah. Not a job thing?
It must have been a job thing. I don't really understand why. Yeah. Maybe it was a housing thing.
What business was your folks in?
Well, my mother was a housewife until later life.
What'd she do later?
Oh, she was interesting.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yes, she, this is in the 70s in Greenville, South Carolina. She became a Head Start teacher.
Yeah.
And then she went on later, they moved to North Carolina, and she worked for a library there. But she didn't have a library science degree. Like, she was just sort of like she was just meant to shelve books and be an assistant, worked in the library.
Yeah.
But she created this whole outreach program where she would take like a bookmobile, but she would tell stories.
Yeah.
And she'd go way out in the sticks.
Really?
And she would read to these kids, and she'd dress up like a witch. She called herself the Witch of Onslow County, and she would go out into the sticks and read these stories, and she would realize that sometimes the parents were hanging around listening and that they were illiterate, like they couldn't read.
Oh, really?
And they're fascinated. And there'd be times when I'd go in the supermarket with her, and like kids would just run, and adults too would run up to her, like, Miss Mary.
Really?
She was like a local hero. Yeah, she really did make something very cool of her life. And she had no college degree or anything.
Huh.
She was an Italian American from Scranton, PA, who married my dad, who was a Southerner,
yeah.
and came down south and was always a fish out of water.
Wow, she just took it upon herself to just spread the joy of reading and performing.
Yeah. And she just loved kids, yes, and performing. And she just loved kids, and I think she just, I don't know how to say this quite. I just think she related to these people that were on the fringes of society or were kind of, like couldn't read or couldn't afford this or that. And she just, because she'd grown up that way. She'd grown up in a really poor family, yeah.
In Scranton.
Yeah, Italian-American family.
Huh. So
they only spoke Italian at home. Like,
so your mom was born in America, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
But she had to start school and learn English, like one of those.
Yeah, it was rough for Italians.
Yeah.
All the immigrants, it was pretty
rough,
man.
Yeah, all the immigrants. Yeah, that's right.
And I can't imagine Pennsylvania was any, party, I guess.
No, and well, it was a big Italian-American component, which I remember the family reunions and so forth growing up, not many of them, but they were just so different than my Southern relatives. And they were so lively and kind and funny and, vulgar and really good cooks and everything. They were all beautiful. All my cousins were like these gorgeous Italian looking,
And expressive.
They were usually completely Italian.
Expressive,
yeah.
And what was the Southern experience with that family?
So my dad was an architect.
Yeah.
So I was get to go back to him. And his dad had been sort of a really prominent architect.
Mm. Down there?
Well, he was from England. And then he'd begun working in New York.
Yeah.
And he worked, and I get these two guys' names mixed up, so we'll have to check this. But I think it was Richard Howland Hunt. mm-hmm. or, but might be Richard Morris Hunt. They were, yeah. I think, a father and son architecture firm,
yeah.
but they built the Metropolitan Museum
oh, wow.
and all these Vanderbilt mansions, and he worked for them, and
yeah.
he worked on a lot of those buildings
oh, wow.
In here in New York,
yeah,
or there, huh?
yeah.
there in
yeah.
New York, where I live.
Yeah.
And then the Biltmore House got built in Asheville, North Carolina,
yeah.
and he was sent down as sort of a resident architect. I mean, a whole firm worked on it,
uh-huh.
but like he knew Olmsted, who did the Central
wow,
Park, he
yeah.
did the grounds there, and
I've he knew
seen pictures,
Olmsted?
And yeah, I've seen pictures of him with his little derby and his, like,
really,
yeah, because he was he had my father late in life, and then my father had me kind of late in life, so it's almost like we skipped a generation.
Huh.
So I would, I mean, that's a you know fascinating, and the way I understand it, my granny was from Glasgow, so
yeah.
he was from Yorkshire,
yeah,
and then. My granny was from Glasgow,
yeah.
and I believe she was like a domestic in the house when the Vanderbilts lived there.
No kidding.
And so they met and fell in love, and then he lived down there.
Wow.
And he became big. He designed a lot of the courthouses in North Carolina. He was like a big, famous architect in North
wow.
Carolina.
Wow.
That's on my dad's family. They're both my parents are first generation American.
Right. So it's not like multi-generational Southern thing. It's
no.
just where he no. ended up.
That's right.
Because of the work. That's kind of
yeah.
wild.
That's where my grand. I don't know why my dad went back there. That was perverse because then, you know.
But your dad was an architect too?
Yeah.
yeah.
And an engineer. You know, he yeah. would do other related things.
Oh,
but, you know.
Did he grow up there?
Yeah. He grew up in Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Which is a really
yeah, I know
groovy
Asheville.
Spot.
Yeah.
Actually.
I like that. I like yeah. Asheville. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
So I guess people just want to go home. That's probably why he went back.
Do you?
Do I? I did for a
I
while.
I want to go home.
I did for a while. You know, I grew up in New Mexico, so that's
oh.
kind of beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
But the weird thing about the idea of that, the romanticizing, the notion, if
yeah.
you come from a beautiful place, like, well, I'm going to go home, is that your heart's looking for something.
Yeah.
Right? Or it's looking to pick up where it left off. Neither oh. of those things are possible.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go home to what you remember as home.
That's
right?
True. Right.
It's weird because if I go home now, if I go to New Mexico, I'm like within 2 days, I'm like, the fuck am I doing here?
Yeah.
Like, I got a couple
yeah.
friends there. My old man's still there and I go see him as he kind of loses his mind.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, but it's not, you know, I think it's an idea. You
yeah,
know?
But there's also people who are like, get me out of this dusty little town. I got to go to New York or I got to
well,
go. Yeah.
I was thinking about going back to New York because I lived there for years too.
Yeah. I mean, that was more my mood take on it. You know,
yeah, when like, did you leave the South?
I started to go to Florida State, and I kept not taking physics.
Yeah.
And not getting above a D in math, and I kept just dropping all those academic classes and just being in plays.
Yeah.
And then I started getting offered jobs, like not hugely well-paid jobs,
yeah.
but started getting acting jobs, and I just sort of gave up the farce of being in college. But,
you started getting acting jobs in Florida?
Yeah. Think of that. I mean, they weren't like, but like be like summer theater or like I did a like an independent film there that then turned out well. And
did they, so did people find you at the school?
Well, with that film, they did.
Yeah.
And then one
what
professor
film was
hired,
it
was called Gal Youngin. It's by Victor Nunez.
Oh.
It's his first full-length feature.
Yeah.
As a teenager.
Yeah.
And then I worked at a regional theater in southern Florida.
What town?
It's, in Miami. Well, in Coconut Grove.
Yeah.
It's not there anymore. But I did a season there when
yeah.
I was still supposed to be in college. And then I moved to New York. So I, yeah.
So you just, did you take classes?
At Florida State?
Yeah. Acting?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Was that the
and it
prime?
Was a big, it was a big theater school. I mean, I guess it still is.
Yeah.
Like, it has an MFA and BFA program in theater.
Uh-huh.
Like it's a proper, you know.
Yeah.
And for the South, if you live in the Southeast, that's maybe a natural place to try to go.
Sure. Is it a big party school?
I guess so, but I mean,
yeah.
That all passed me by.
you're too busy.
I was
you're
too
in the,
focused.
In the drama department.
That's right.
Over there doing that.
That's right.
With all the misfits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Not too many.
Some misfits and some blind ambition, you know. Like,
oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know, like this friend of mine calls, there's a certain type of actress called a chainsaw ingenue.
Oh, wow. Oh, really?
Well,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
that
yeah.
really
sure.
ambitious ingenue.
Sure.
That when you're young, when you start out in your career, that's your age
just
group.
Eating
and
up
just,
the scenery.
It's like, Jesus, you
yeah.
know, it's bad enough to have, you know, all these external problems with trying to get a job, but
yeah.
then to have
that
these
girl.
Yeah. those people.
But like, what's like, what, well, out of those people that you remember who were of that ilk, did they rise? Did they succeed?
Yeah, some of them, because they're so driven.
Oh, really? They're still around?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, wow.
Well, yeah, but now I'm thinking of my whole, you know,
yeah,
my whole, all my early, ingenue years,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, some of them definitely, and some of them were flameouts, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like some people with the biggest sort of bravado, you know, they kind of crumble after, you know, the first wave of rejection and failure.
Yeah.
You know, they don't
pushing
have
pushing too hard to.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, just.
It's painful to watch, though. It's awful.
The ego is fragile when they're that much of a spectacle of themselves, unless they've really got the goods.
I don't know why it seemed like the ingenues, like the girls were the most like this, but, you know, because. Maybe not. I think the boys were still kind of like not admitting they wanted to be actors.
Yeah.
That's not really manly or whatever.
Yeah. That but, was a, that's an interesting thing, that whole not manliness of acting. Like I talked to some old timer, I can't remember who, where they were really up against that, where it was not a profession. Like they.
Not a serious profession for a guy.
Right. Oh, yeah. But, you know, they had to, like in film, it had to be made kind of, you know, masculine at some point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The whole, there was a generation of actors there that were, had to go out and live the life.
Yeah.
You know, like the Steve McQueens of the world. And, yeah.
Or even earlier, I would think like Joel McRae.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, having a ranch and, sure. you know, all those guys had ranches and rode horses. And,
yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and some of them were crazy, man, in the 70s.
In
earlier. Yeah. Like, because I read a book about the making of The Wild Bunch, and it's like, the amount that these guys drank and rode dangerous vehicles and stuff, it was like, what the fuck? How'd they, any of them survive? It's crazy.
Wait, what is the, remind me.
That was the Sam Peckinpah movie.
Oh,
in
right.
the 70s with, you know, with William Holden, Warren Oates, Ernest Borgnine.
Wow, what a lineup.
Oh, and it's an insane movie.
But
it's just, masculinity, interesting. So you come to New York, how old are you?
I was probably 21 when I finally.
What was going on there? What year was that? 81, 82?
I think it might have been 81. Something like that. Wait a minute. I'm a little foggy on this.
Because I
came to New York kind of for a while and just auditioned for other regional theater gigs.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really get an apartment. So it was kind of a gradual thing.
Yeah.
But then when I finally got a job that was in New York.
Yeah.
I had auditioned for this national tour of this play, Crimes of the Heart, Beth Henley's play.
I remember that one.
Yeah. And I was kind of like, well, I don't know if I want to go on a tour, but it was obviously a well-paying job and like great roles for women and all that. So I knew I would take it if I got it, but I was kind of ambivalent about it.
It cast out of New York?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was on Broadway currently.
Yeah. Okay.
And they were trying to launch the national tour. And then they postponed the national tour. But about that time, the actress playing the youngest sister gave notice and they offered me the part. So my first job in New York was on Broadway.
Wow.
Which was just like.
That's crazy. Did you have an agent and stuff?
No. I mean, I had someone who, you know, took credit for that, like because the casting director called and said, remember, there was some girl who was good at had a good Southern accent who I saw for Tender Mercies or something, you know, and like, and then they'd had to look it up because I wasn't signed with them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then
you were
then,
but I guess you were after that, though.
After that, I got a good agent.
Was it them?
No, it was not them.
Oh, good.
No.
They took credit, though.
Well, you know, what I mean is they took their commission.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Of course. All right.
You know.
So that experience, who else was in that play with you?
Holly Hunter.
Wow.
We were both replacements, Holly Hunter and I. And then almost everyone else was, I think, in the original cast. Elizabeth McKay played the older sister.
I can't imagine the leap. It must have been just.
Oh, my God. It was surreal.
Yeah.
It was surreal. And that what had happened, too, is that in the first cast, it had been Mary Beth Hurt in the role that Holly played later. Hunter later played. And then my part was played by Mia Dillon. And Maya Dillon. Sorry. Maya Dillon. And so every time. One of the first casts, like, so Mary Beth had, like, the star, the number one dressing room.
Yeah.
And so when she would leave, then Maya went in there.
Yeah.
And then when Maya gave notice, they were all going to shuffle around again. And the stage manager was like, that's enough. Whoever replaces Maya is going in there. So I, not only my first job was in New York, but I was in the fucking, you know, number one dressing room and with a, you know, a theater full of women who'd worked their way up the ladder, the understudies and the other sisters.
It's big and it's got a shower and everything.
Well, I don't remember it had a shower, but it was all decorated. Ah. It was the first little floor up. It had the star on the door. You know, it was like the star dressing room. The Golden.
Yeah. Is that still around?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's still called the Golden. I think it was called something else for a while.
Huh.
Maybe it's called the Golden.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was really exciting.
So then does the career just take off then?
Well, you know, in a fashion, you know how that is. Like,
well, I mean, well, you're well, when you do a play, you're in the play for a while.
That's right. I was in for like 7 months.
Oh, so you're just locked in making a living.
Yes. That was a refreshing new feeling.
And then what happens? I mean, how do you become like sort of a force to be reckoned with on stage?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing is that
or just
then,
working. I mean, it seems like there's a few people in the succession that are also kind of working.
Lots
New York
of theater
stage.
Actors. Yeah. Lots of
that. That's a world.
It is.
And it still exists.
Yeah.
Only in New York, really, for the most part. Maybe London, I think.
London. Yeah.
But
and Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Where people can live and work because there's enough productions going on.
Yeah.
But it is sort of a specific and unique community, New York theater actors.
True, yeah. I know, and it's such a old tradition. I mean, it's such a, you know, institution.
Like, yeah, and who do you find that you're, like, how do you integrate into that community? I mean, who are you meeting? When did you meet Kenneth?
Oh, well, he's my second marriage, and so I didn't meet him for a long time.
What happened with the first guy? Was he an actor?
He was trying to be an actor at that point, and he discovered like writing comedy and writing, and he had much more success as that. And
oh yeah,
and we split up pretty quickly.
Pretty quick. Oh, but he was somebody you met in New York?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Because
well, we were doing a play out of town, but yes.
Oh, okay.
We both lived in New York.
But it was a quick marriage.
I thought it was going to be the marriage.
Oh,
you know?
Did?
But it didn't turn out that way.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. But I have a really good husband now, and we're married 23 years.
That's a lot.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So I have no regrets. But at the time, it was awful.
Yeah, it's a terrible
thing.
Divorce is terrible. It's a nightmare. But so after this play, though, I don't know if I talked to some theater actors. I don't know if specifically talk about it, but it seems like you were, you've done a lot of it.
Yes.
A ton. And that life is sort of specific. How does it sort of, so you get done with the, with Crimes of the Heart, and then what happens?
You start, you know, you're just always auditioning, especially when you're starting out.
For anything? Because it's like, you know, I mean, the New York theater scene is not just Broadway.
No.
Yeah.
And it's doesn't pay very well. I don't know what to liken it to. I think it's probably a lot of artistic or entertainment type things are like this, where you're building something and you're building your craft and you're getting better and better at it and you're meeting people that are stimulating and funny and interesting and you're being, you know, influenced and influencing other people.
Yeah.
And it's really heady.
Yeah.
It's like this great, you feel privileged that you're part of it. And you may not, you know, you're making your rent, but you're not getting rich, you know.
Sure.
So, but
you're part of a tradition.
Part of a whole thing, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but one casualty of it is that you kind of have to just go from play to play. Like what you know, you audition and you pick the best one you get offered.
Yeah.
And you can't really afford to just lay out too long hoping to get the lead in the new Scorsese movie.
Right.
You know, you just go from play to play.
So in terms of film and television, that wasn't the primary focus.
Film and television?
Yeah.
No.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
I really loved theater. It's a real, you know, it's a real writer's medium and medium and also an actor's medium.
Like, yeah.
It's really like, you know, a wordy scene in a TV show would be like 5 pages long
sure,
or something.
Sure, it's the worst.
In a play, you go on for 20 minutes in a scene, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's, you're your own editor.
Yeah, and no one's stopping the
light, no one's stopping it, and it's, you have lots and lots to say.
Yeah.
And so it's really, it's a very creative thing.
No, it's great. And especially if you're doing a new play.
Yeah, which I did a lot of. That
you
was
did.
That was my preferred thing. I loved,
And then you're starting from workshopping almost.
That's right.
And everything, you know, you're evolving while you're in it.
That's very fun. It's very exciting. Yeah.
But it's a taxing kind of racket, the stage.
Yeah. I mean, after a while, I was like, I'm never going to get out of this pay grade if I don't, like, you know, people who dance and sing can you know, land in a big, well-paying Broadway musical from time to time. And that's really lucrative comparatively.
Yeah.
But doing plays off Broadway is not, you know, it's like rent money.
Yeah.
So if that.
Yeah.
So you can kind of get stuck in it. And so at some point I just had to be like, I'm going to try to do more television. I remember about the time, when Breaking Bad was first on.
Yeah.
And my friend Alan Ball was doing True Blood.
Yeah.
And we go back to college. He was at Florida State when I was. And he offered me a part on it. And I came out here to do it. And he had just discovered Breaking Bad. He was like, oh, you have to see this show. And then I just remember I was kind of by myself. My family weren't with me at first because I was just out here.
Yeah.
Like staying in a shitty apartment in West Hollywood. And watching like all of The Wire and all of these shows and being like, it's different TV that I grew up with, or what I was auditioning for when in my 20s, The Equalizer and Law and Order. Nothing against Law and Order, because that underwrites the New York theater, or it did.
Yeah.
You know, but, and you know, everybody loves those shows too.
Yeah.
But boy, TV, as everyone's been saying now for a decade or more, has blossomed and flourished into this like very creative, very diverse.
Well, yeah. The limited series thing is the thing.
The limited series thing and just... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's shows about every possible thing you can think of.
But also, there are shows where, like, I started to notice it recently because I've watched a couple of different – I just watched a screener of this HBO thing coming out based on that Texas murder, the, you know, the Love and Death with Elizabeth Olsen and Lily Rabe.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's a limited series. Jesse Plemons is in it, too.
Oh, he's
– and I just noticed, like, everyone's acting the fuck out of this thing. I mean, they're really dug in.
Yeah.
Characters are deep. And they've got time to do it.
Yeah.
To make, you know, to deepen these characters, to have real arcs.
Yes.
And transformation.
Arcs.
Yeah.
What a concept.
Yeah. And it's like, it's kind of astounding when, you know, actors can dig in like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I always think that's part of the success of my show, Succession.
Yeah.
The success of Succession is that it's... it sort of requires the audience to think and listen and keep track, and like it doesn't explain things.
Yeah.
Might mention something, and then if it nags at you, you're like, what do they mean by that? What is that going to lead to? And like it's full of little clues and Easter eggs. And, and I think audiences are really love that actually.
Yeah, they love it, and also like this. I just like the non-streaming element. Like
waiting for Sunday night to come.
I do. It's better. Yeah. It's a lot to process. It's
suspenseful.
Because I've watched, like I've done that sort of thing where, you know, I watched Breaking Bad when it came out.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, I'm going to watch it again because the girlfriend hasn't seen it. And then you watch 2-3 in a row and it's exhausting. You're not supposed to put that much shit in your head.
I know, that much violence. That's the thing.
It's exhausting. You know, this is a thing that took someone 2 years to make.
I know.
And you're just going to like dump it all into you. Like it's, and you can't stop.
I don't know. Some people really get a lot of the binging thing. But.
I do, but it's like, it's literally like binging anything is afterwards you feel tired. You don't remember it as well.
You're bloated. You need to lie down.
A little bit mentally, emotionally. So, but I have to assume though that do you know Lily?
I've met her.
Oh, you never work with her? Mm-mm. But like, there's all these characters in the world of the stage. Did you get to meet all the old characters?
Definitely. Oh my God, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
Like who? Like who are your heroes that you got to work with or meet?
Oh, gee. I mean, I didn't get to work with all of them, but you know, I got to meet all these like great stage actors, Marion Seldes and Zoe Caldwell. And I was in this play for a year of my life on Broadway called Lend Me a Tenor. Like silly fun, but it took place in the 30s. Uh-huh. It was really like a farce. Really fun. Victor Garber was in it. Philip Bosco was in it. Jane Cannell was in it. It was like really like the royal family of Broadway of the at the time. And I mean, just the stories you'd hear and like, so great, so great.
Was there insanity?
Yeah, there's some insanity.
how out of control has it gotten out there on stage where things get awry?
Man, there's been some crazy and stressful things, but just fun. I had this play I did as Bees and Honey Drown. I played this fantastic character by this playwright, Douglas Carter Bean, and she was, turns out to be a con artist. And it all takes place in like, I guess it's supposed to be like early 90s or mid 90s. And she's, you know, everything's fabulous and it's all Paramount Hotel and all the groovy bars then. And it's all Madonna and, you know, she's dropping names constantly. And so it starts off, though, that it's almost just like this romantic comedy. And you don't find out she's a con artist till the end of Act One. And then Act Two is a deconstruction of Act One going, wait a minute, what were her tells, you know? And who was she really? And we got to see how she created this persona for herself.
Oh, interesting.
And it was really interesting and really fun, but like a talk fest. And at one point in Act Two, when you are seeing how she's trying to develop this like fabulous club, you know, groovy Soho personality, and she's her real identity is Brenda Gelb from Pennsylvania, and she's got this boyfriend she's in love with. He's gay, but she won't realize it. She won't face up to it, and he wants to teach her how to be fabulous. So he shows her Rosalind Russell, Tallulah Bankhead, Audrey Hepburn, and Liza Minnelli. And she, you know, memorizes their characterizations. And that all rolled into one becomes her persona.
Wow.
So she's this, like, infectious, really fun character.
Yeah.
But there was this scene where you got to see me, you know, doing these impressions back to back. And I'd be like, I remember one night looking at Scott, who played my boyfriend, and like, I already did Liza, right? Oh, God. He would cue me, be like, you've got that one, honey. You try Lifeboat.
So he knew?
Yeah, we know each other's lines.
It's so wild.
Camaraderie. It's fantastic.
When you're on stage and something goes awry, it's amazing. Because, like, you know, the pace of the play is the pace of play, and if you're in it, you're in it. But, you know, usually not on autopilot. You're just, you're engaged.
Yes.
And then when something happens, it's like you have that moment where it's just like, oh, my God.
Oh, my God, I know.
I watched it. Like, I remember certain things happening where things, like I saw Gary Sinise's Buried Child.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a good production. I don't think it lasted very long. And it's a heavy play. Mm. And what's his name? Terry Kinney, mm-hmm. you know, is the lead in that. You know, and there's that scene where he walks in with all the corn, you know, just like, and then like, I just remember the night I saw it, this one corn ear
rolled off the stage.
It's just like, and you just gotta let, nothing you can do, but he's being upstaged in a very heavy moment by just watching that
one
corn.
One cob
going down, yeah.
That's a Sam Shepard play, right?
Yeah. I remember I was on stage in a college production of Don't Drink the Water, you know, the Woody Allen play.
Oh, cool.
It's a big, goofy play.
Yeah.
But there's a scene where, you know, it's at an embassy and it all ends up at like a Russian embassy, or I can't remember. But a bomb comes in the window and I'm this old Jewish guy and it's supposed to land. I pick it up and I'm like, what's this? You know, it's a bomb. We throw it back. It's all goofy. But the one night it flew in the window right into the audience. The bomb just...
They evacuate the theater.
Well, no, it was one of those things where how do you, you know, so I try to improvise and I go, what was that? And then the other guy goes, I don't know. I didn't see it.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So that now really we're just, helps. So eventually I just went to the lip of the stage. I'm like, give me it.
Yeah.
And I go, it's a bomb, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. It's weird because you do have to honor something. I mean, you're not supposed to take it out of the play. You know what I mean?
Well, listen, so one of my first jobs I got, I don't know if you can leave this in
Why?
The conversation. Well, let me tell it. It's a funny story. So one of my first jobs when I was supposed to be taking physics in Florida was I was in this children's theater. And it was kind of a good children's theater. We did good plays usually. Yeah. And this one, we did this one holiday one that was very stupid. And we did one section was supposed, like one was supposed to be about Hanukkah, actually, and one about, I guess, Kwanzaa or something. Yeah. Anyway, we did the Christian one, the one about the nativity and everything.
Yeah.
And we're trying to think how, what, you know, a little 15-minute sketch sort of as part of this play for these little bitty kids.
Yeah.
And so my friend John Youngblood and I were a sheep and a cow in the manger with Joseph and Mary.
Yeah.
And we get in a little argument because we've got a lot of pride about our gift that we're making, that we're offering.
For the baby Jesus.
The baby Jesus.
Yeah.
And I think mine was that I was knitting I was the sheep.
Yeah.
And I was going to knit a sweater out of my wool, and John was a cow, and he was going to make ice cream for the baby.
Yeah, sure.
And then we got into this, it was a very weak play. We got in this fight about you know, we were being too proud, prideful, and we ruined our gifts, supposedly, because of this fight, because the ice cream got on the sweater, and there was no more ice cream, and the sweater was stained, and we had a big fight.
Yeah.
And then the way the play had been structured was that there was audience participation, but you carefully set everything up so that you always get the answer you need for the story to go forward.
Sure.
So, like, what do we do now? Well, you've kind of put that, you've laid the seeds, and some kid goes, go behind that door, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
We're in that point of the play. And it was like 9 a.m. in some school in Louisville, Kentucky in December. And all the teachers are sitting in benches on the side of the gymnasium. We're like, we've marked out our stage on the floor of a gym.
Yeah.
These little bitty kids are half asleep. And they had to sit like crisscross on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Like crossway and just like.
Yes.
No, like. No chairs.
Yes. Yeah. On the floor. And the teachers aren't paying attention at all.
Ugh.
And so we carefully set up that really what the Christ child wanted from us was our heart, our love.
Yeah.
So that had been set up, and we're like, no, we know better. I have a sweater. I'm going to make ice cream.
Yeah.
So then we set it up so that what will we do? What can we give him? What will we do?
Yeah.
The answer was very easy. We planted it very obviously. Give him your heart.
Yeah.
And one kid who wasn't paying attention just went, kill him. And you're not supposed to pick up these like errant weirdo things, but I was so shocked. That woke me up. Like we were all asleep. Like the actors were asleep, the teachers were asleep, the kids were asleep. I was like, what? He said, kill him, kill the baby. And then that whole side of the theater started chanting, kill the baby.
Oh my God. The baby Jesus.
The baby Jesus. Yeah. We were like, no, let's start back. Let's start back.
What the teachers do, nothing.
They're just chatting. They were gossiping.
Oh,
they had no idea.
Oh my God.
Just one of those.
Yes, that's it. And that's,
yes.
You know, that would
day
be a big problem
of,
now. Yeah.
Yes.
you want to make note of that kid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't know what we're talking. I mean,
he was just being Joker.
I think he was even just lost his place in the story. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know what he thought we were talking
God.
About.
Those moments are just crazy, on stage. I've had a lot of weird moments on stage.
I bet you have. Yeah.
With audience members or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah.
So what's it like, day to day, living with Kenneth Lonergan?
Well, it's no day at the beach. No, he's great.
But like, I mean, do you guys? I mean, you were both deeply involved in the controversy around that movie Margaret in terms of like releasing the correct print of it,
right?
And I mean. Like that's a masterpiece, that movie, huh?
I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that was a hard time.
When you work, you're in the movie, but I have to assume that when he's working on something or writing, you know, how involved does he let you be?
Well, I would say generally I leave him alone.
No, but does he want you to read things?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, the general rule of thumb is like he needs private, like he needs to.
Don't bother me.
Well, you know that thing, you must have this, like where if you talk about it too much, you won't write it.
Yes.
Like you feel like it's written or something.
Yeah.
So we just don't talk about it usually, but sometimes he'll say, will you read this version of this?
Yeah.
And, you know, tell me what you think.
And
he also, he likes to do readings with actors.
Oh, he does.
As a way of seeing if a scene works and like.
For film too?
Yeah. For TV, everything. Like just, that's one of his big tips he tells writers.
That's like
get
that's
good
interesting.
Actors to read it. Yeah.
Well, that you know,
aloud. You know,
Sedaris does that with essays.
No kidding.
Like you know, when he does readings and stuff.
Yeah.
Like he'll make note of where laughs are.
Oh yeah.
Uh huh.
Well, that makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
Why not make it as funny as possible?
Where they aren't is more.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah.
So funny. You know?
So like, so do you get involved with those readings sometimes?
His yeah. Kenny's readings. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And oh, that's interesting.
All the time. Because he says it's like, you know, it's sort of like a great screener for like where there's too much or where there's bullshit or where
right.
something's awkward to say. Like if you have really good actors, they will make it work if it can work.
Yeah.
Like innately, they will,
sure.
they will give it truth. So if you have really good actors, read it aloud. You'll see where it lags. You'll see where it this and that, you know.
Yeah.
It's really kind of cool system.
Well, yeah, because you can, I mean, especially well with movies, it's good to sort of, you know, get rid of stuff you don't need early, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, with TV, like, it seems a little different because you're kind of looking for things. Like, what are we going to
yeah.
do? With, you know,
yeah, maybe
we,
so.
We need some more stuff here.
Yeah.
Like, it was a little odd to me, the Succession thing, when Logan's girlfriend and assistant, what's her name?
Carrie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
She's my good friend Zoe.
Yeah, Zoe. Like, she wants to be an on-air talent.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like, where did that come from? Do you know what I mean? Because yeah. they were sort of setting her up last season. Like, it looked like she was going to get pregnant.
I know. She was trying to get pregnant.
Right.
Because yeah.
she's giving him the smoothies with
yeah.
the stuff.
I know.
And then all of a sudden, it's like I don't know when it happens when you're creating a season of television where somebody says, like, why don't we make her, she wants to be on-air talent.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because it was surprising to me.
I think that character is supposed to be one of those chainsaw
climbers?
Ingenues.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like
sure.
he just wants
yeah.
to be famous maybe or, you know.
Oh, interesting.
So drawn to his power and his.
But writing. Oh, so the baby fantasy crapped out?
I don't know.
Oh, you can't tell.
Well,
me.
You know, who knows?
Yeah,
they
I
have
guess.
A sequel. She may have.
Oh, yeah.
She may be knocked up. I don't
oh,
know.
Oh, yeah. I don't. Yeah. It was just sort of like one of those things that added a real menace to it. Because
yeah.
he like expelling the old children and just sort of like this idea that there would be this. I wonder if that was just a storyline. They were like, we're not going to follow that through.
I think there's a lot of those in all TV.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But, okay, so with Margaret, I mean, what was that? Because I don't know that. I feel like not enough people have seen that movie now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What was the struggle?
Well, Margaret, it was like an epic.
Yeah.
It was an epic. Like
yeah.
the theme of it and also just it was long,
yeah,
but I don't think excessively long because, well, part of the action of the play is
yeah.
the tedium of getting stuck in a legal battle,
yeah,
that you want to get real, you want to get some moral satisfaction out of, and then it's really you get weighed down in tedium. So part of the story is supposed to be about that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, it's just an epic. It's like a teen drama epic. About
yeah, early young Kieran.
Young Kieran
yeah.
and Anna Paquin.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these great, Sarah Steele, yeah. all these people were in it.
Allison Janney, briefly.
Allison Janney, yes.
Under a bus.
Yeah, she's so what? Good, yeah. So many good people in it.
Yeah.
But it truly is an epic. And
yeah.
then, you know, there, like when he brought it to the producer the first
yeah.
time to read, it was like, you know, the phone book. And
yeah.
he, you know, but everyone was like, shoot it all and then we'll edit it. And then
right.
that just became tricky. Like,
right, sure.
you
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and then how to not throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I think they should just let it be a longer movie. It's long anyway.
Yeah, but now there's two still, versions of it out there, right?
Yeah, but even the one they were okay with is long.
Yeah.
So like it's kind of just became a pissing contest in my opinion.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of, we had a little kid, you know, and we had our daughter by then, and
yeah.
I did not, I stayed out of the
uh-huh.
real insanity at that
yeah.
time. But it was heartbreaking. Such a good movie.
Yeah.
With so many good performances in it.
It's crazy.
Crazy. And such a good, you know, just a good story.
But he seemed like, I interviewed him, and he seems like a relatively socially evolved person. Like, he's not a brooding genius, you know, it doesn't seem.
He's kind of broody. Yeah, he's kind of, He's kind of.
He must have been on chipper behavior with me.
Yeah, no, he does have a. No, he. I know. There's sociable Kenny, and he can be the life of the party.
Yeah.
He's very witty.
Yeah. And, did you guys do a lot of that? Did you do a lot of entertaining in the theater world?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A fair amount.
That's fun,
as a matter
right?
of fact, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, when he's working and stuff, he can get in a funk. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because, well, well, writers work, he works at home.
And but like, also, like, you know,
like,
he.
Get out
like,
of the house. You're just going to get.
But his like, themes are, you know, I mean, you know, you would have to be sort of. Down
yeah,
in it.
Soulful kind of, yeah.
Yeah, soulful and.
Human
and,
condition kind of.
Yeah, the heartbreaking.
Moral dilemmas.
Darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, yeah, soul searching kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's a bit of a depressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he working on a thing?
Bunch of things.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like what?
I don't know if I have liberty to say.
All right.
But like he's working on a play.
Oh, good.
He's working on two different movie scripts. He's working on a TV thing.
Wow.
So we'll see what happens first.
And you?
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, I have a couple of little jobs coming up, but I want to, I kind of, now I'm really interested in maybe becoming one of those performers that write their own material.
Because, oh, yeah?
Yeah, because.
Why not?
Why not? That's what some of the best stuff turns out to be.
Yeah.
And it's hard to be a woman of a certain age. Mm. And, I mean, that was a wake-up call. To play Jerry because she was a real dimensional person. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was my input, what mm-hmm. I brought to it and what they encouraged me to do and how they met me halfway and wrote for me. Mm. So I'm like, well, why should I, you know, so many parts, supporting parts or parts for older people, not just women, older people, are kind of stock. You know, they're sort of boring. And I think,
yeah,
well, you know.
On film and television? Just,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know how it'll go, but I really want to. That's my next thing is I want to try to
find a
create content for myself
zone.
And my friends and and like maybe I don't know be in a little collective that we kind of support each other and write for each other, get ideas.
Well, it's very interesting to me, you know, the a person's place in you know the culture after a certain age, you know, especially on film and television, like so much of that stuff. Just in general, a lot of TV is. Limiting, and you know it going in, you're going to read it and be like, ugh, that's it?
Yeah.
And it becomes a drag.
Well, that's one reason I was in theater for so long.
Yeah.
Is that the TV parts were soul killing.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
Usually.
Yeah.
Unless you were the lead, and often then that case too.
But it's interesting what I'm seeing too in comedy, or specifically at the Comedy Store where I work primarily. And I had someone in here a couple of weeks ago, Kathy Ladman, who's a stand-up who's been doing it forever. And she's in her 60s. And, you know, and Jimmy Fallon had her on, which it was completely – just the presence of a woman her age and proudly sort of gray hair doing her bits and killing. You just don't see it.
No.
And I was so happy that Jimmy did it. And then there's a couple of old-timers at the store who, like Tom Dreesen, used to open for Frank Sinatra.
Good Lord.
He's, you know, he's got to be in his late 60s, early 70s. And Argus Hamilton is another guy that's around in that age group. And there's a patter to it that is very familiar to everybody from their childhood. There's a way of presenting.
Yeah.
And there's a gravitas that comes with it. And they kill. And there's like, you know, and it's sort of a beautiful thing that, you know, goes unnoticed because you don't see it.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing it. And I'm like, you know, there's so many voices of experience and wisdom of a certain age person that just doesn't have a place in the culture.
Right.
And it is a little disturbing.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting that age.
Yeah. So we have to write our own shit, man.
Yeah. What are you thinking?
I'm not going to.
Okay. You don't
talk
like you don't
about
want to
it.
Talk about it. You're just going to do it?
Yeah. I'm gonna. Well, we'll see. We'll see. We'll see.
You're going to do it.
Yeah, I'm going
to
do it.
When I'm trying to build an hour of stand-up, I'll just go get a small theater, do a residency, and fucking figure it out.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh, I'd like to follow you around and watch that.
Yeah. I mean, but that's what you can do, especially in New York. I mean, with no pressure, if you have a crew or you have, you know, a way of getting a few people in there to workshops, if you tell the audience that this is what it is and thank you for being here, I'm glad you appreciate it, but I don't really know how this is going to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can do it.
People are probably supportive.
Of course. Yeah. And something real is happening.
Yeah.
You know?
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you.
You too.
I'm glad you did it.
You too. Yeah. We have to talk about.
What?
Betty Gilpin.
Oh, what about her? I'm going to go see. I just heard from her.
Oh, I love her. I was in her first play that she did out of drama school. And
really?
She is, talking about funny people, I think she's one of the funniest people I've ever known.
Oh, a great mind, a great wit. You were
great
in a play.
Beauty. Oh, yeah, my God.
You were in a play she wrote?
No.
Oh, just you were
her
with
first
her?
Play out of, yeah. I was in a play with her.
How is that?
And she was just new on the scene. And I just, you know, I knew her parents. Her parents are both actors.
Big actors, yeah. Big stage people.
So they were kind of.
Did you know her as a baby?
That means,
did you see
her,
them around?
No, they were kind of like a little bit ahead of me. You
okay.
know? So I didn't really know them. I knew who they were.
Sure.
And then Betty was just so like beautiful and shy. And she played this part really heartbreakingly, and she played this sort of awkward character. And,
yeah.
And then she would just be so fucking funny in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And like, and.
Yeah, she's something.
And she's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And not all of those things go together all the time. And I just, that's someone we have in common.
Oh, yeah, she's great. She just, I guess they're going to do a premiere of her new TV show that has something to do with nuns. She just texted me about it at the DGA Theater. I guess they're just going to have a couple episodes. I'll go check it out. I have no idea what
it has
it's
to do
about.
With nuns?
Yeah. I don't know what the show is. But she was, it was very interesting working with her on Glow for so many seasons, because like the two leads of that, you know, Alison Brie and Gilpin really come from different disciplines of acting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Their tools were different, like, but they were both very effective. But it's definitely two different approaches. And you never knew what the fuck Betty was going to do.
Yeah. That's great, though, right?
It's great. Of course it is. She's keeping it interesting and funny and weird.
Just her Instagram.
Yeah. I haven't watched it. I get on. Is it good?
Really good. Really funny. I haven't looked at it lately, but.
Did you read her book?
No, she has a book.
Yeah. She has a book.
I didn't even know that.
Oh, you want it?
Yeah.
I have one. Yeah.
I'd love it.
Yeah.
Well, when you see her, say hi from Jay.
I will do that. I'll text her right after this.
Okay.
Good talking to you.
You too.
Okay, new episodes of Succession are on Sunday nights on HBO. You can stream every episode on HBO Max. Hang out, will you? Hang out for a second. For other episodes with the Succession cast, you can check out Jeremy Strong from episode 1377, Alan Ruck from episode 1270, Kieran Culkin from episode 1150, Sarah Snook from episode 1147, and Brian Cox from episode 1090. It is interesting that the way you see Logan is this nihilistic vacuum.
Yeah.
Who is playing a game, really, right?
That's right. And I said that, you know, we did, in the first series, I said, it's a game.
Yeah.
And the kids don't get it.
Yeah.
They think it's a matter of, like, they don't get the fact it's a game.
They're taking it too seriously.
You know, they take it too seriously, and they don't get it. And, of course, Logan, like all games, he takes it really seriously. But they don't get the game. So they can't get onto the game. And of course, at the end of the...
It's a generational thing.
It's a generational thing. But at the end of the last series, the youngest boy, because he's, well, my eldest of my second family, my heir apparent, Kendall, he's pushed him and pushed him and pushed him. And he's pushed him to such an point that he's actually going to have to make some...
It's a great ending.
You know, sometimes. And
it's
of
great.
Course, he's a proud father.
Yeah. That is the beat at the end.
Yeah. He's a proud father. He says, oh, look, the kid did well.
All of those episodes are available for free in whatever podcast app you're using right now and at WTFpod.com. You can get every episode of WTF ad-free by signing up for WTF Plus. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. I'm just playing basic rock guitar. That's what I'm doing now. All right? Just cranked up the Les Paul. It's been done before by me, probably. More than three times. Slightly different, maybe. Slightly different. Here we go. Boomer lives. Monkey and La Fonda, cat angels everywhere.